from Pacifico Radio. This is Democracy Now!
Do both of you believe that the death penalty actually deters crime, Governor?
I do. That's the only reason to be for it. Let me finish this.
Sure.
I don't think you should support the death penalty to seek revenge. I don't think that's right. I think the reason to support the death penalty is because it saves other people's lives.
Vice President Gore?
I think it is a deterrence. I know that's a controversial view, but I do believe it's a deterrence.
Mr. Nader, you've long expressed your opposition to the death penalty. Your response to your opponents?
Gore and Bush, they're both for the death penalty. They're both for cracking down on street crime but ignoring corporate crime, which takes far more lives.
What Democracy Now! Sounds like. Today, the last presidential debate with Bush, Gore, and, well, police may have thrown him out, but we didn't, Ralph Nader. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I am Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. After 28 hours of intensive diplomatic intervention, the Israelis and the Palestinians have agreed to take immediate steps to apply a tourniquet to the bloodshed, as the New York Times put it, and prevent the raging violence in the West Bank and Gaza from turning into a cataclysmic escalation. We're joined on the telephone right now by Genevieve Abdu, who is an American journalist. She's been a correspondent with The Guardian in Iran, author of No God But God, Egypt and the Triumph of Islam. And she joins us on the phone right now. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Genevieve Abdu.
Thank you. Good morning.
Can you tell us about, well, really two things that have been going on in Egypt? One is the Sharm el-Sheikh Committee Summit, and the other are parliamentary elections there.
Yes, the summit, of course, was held in Sharm el-Sheikh as an attempt to stop the violence. But as we see today, the violence is continuing, and expectations were very low at the summit, even at the outset. But I think both sides felt that there needed to be some sort of agreement. Not to have an agreement and to end the summit would have been, I think, a complete failure. But, of course, the question remains open today whether an agreement can really stop the violence.
And what about the parliamentary elections? Are there any repercussions in terms of the support for President Mubarak's party in terms of the impact of what's going on in Palestine and Israel?
Unfortunately, the elections in Egypt aren't very fair. Most of the parties being allowed to run candidates support the government. And the only party which had been tolerated in Egypt for many years, which was an Islamist party, was banned in July. So the election is not really a true test of public opinion, but what is a great demonstration of how Egyptians feel are the protests that have occurred in Egypt over the last several weeks. And there is no doubt that these protests have certainly pressured President Mubarak into making the kind of statements that he made at Sharm el-Sheikh, in which he criticized the peace process. This was definitely a reversal to some extent of his position, which, of course, has been that he is a great mediator between Israelis and Palestinians. So it is very significant that public opinion in Egypt has played some role in President Mubarak's position.
Ariel Sharon has broken off talks about joining an emergency unity government in Israel. He's blaming Israeli concessions at the Mideast summit in Egypt. What do you think this will mean, Genevieve?
I think that, of course, he also has to be concerned about public opinion in his own country. And this, of course, brings the crisis to a very critical point. There had been a lot of discussion that he would try to form a unity government with Ariel Sharon. If that in fact does not turn out, then of course he will face a lot of pressure from the Israeli public. And the violence, of course, has put a lot of pressure on Mr. Barak to somehow force Yasser Arafat to end the protests and the Palestinians throwing stones, which of course Mr. Arafat can't necessarily do.
And in terms of the other Arab leaders that the United States has tried to isolate in the past, such as Iraq and Iran, what has the latest round of violence, what impact has that had on those policies?
The latest violence has certainly unified the Arab world, which is not unified very often. We have seen that Arab leaders now have made very harsh statements against Israeli aggression, despite the fact that the Israelis say, for example, that they're not using live ammunition. The evidence is to the contrary. Most of Palestinians who have been injured have been shot from the waist up with gunfire. And so the Arab world is quite united against the aggression by the Palestinians, and this is a very significant turning point in the Arab world.
And the parliamentary elections taking place in Egypt now?
The parliamentary elections probably will not necessarily produce any relevant outcome. It is likely that, as before in many parliamentary elections held in Egypt, candidates supporting the government will be elected. As I mentioned, opposition parties aren't allowed to run their own candidates. The only important change which has occurred is that judges now will be monitoring the balloting. Egypt's Supreme Court last July issued an opinion requiring the judges to monitor the voting because the court said that Egyptian elections historically have been based on fraud, and even went as far as to say that the current Egyptian parliament is illegitimate because of an illegal election which was held in 1995.
Willa, we want to thank you very much for being with us. Genevieve Abdu, American journalist, author of No God But God, Egypt and the Triumph of Islam. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move to another set of elections, these right here at home. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Well, Juan, for the third Tuesday in a row, Republican Governor George Bush and Democratic Vice President Al Gore met at a privately sponsored event billed as a presidential debate.
So what did Lloyd Benson say to one time to Dan Quayle in a vice presidential debate? Dan Quayle, you're no John Kennedy. Well, this was certainly no Kennedy-Nixon debates that we've seen in the last few weeks. In fact, I had trouble staying awake at all three of them, Amy, I must confess.
Well, inside University Hall in St. Louis, Missouri, Bush and Gore responded to questions from members of a live audience in what's come to be called a town hall-style meeting, with PBS NewsHour anchor Jim Lehrer again moderating. For the second time in the three, well, what we'll call joint presidential candidate appearances, Green Party presidential candidate Ralph Nader tried to attend, but he was forced to leave the Washington University campus by the university police chief. The event was sponsored by the Commission on Presidential Debates, which is corporate funded mostly by Anheuser-Busch. Ford's involved as well. The Democratic and Republican former chairs of each party are the appointed heads of that commission. Well, the commission set a bar of 15% of popular support in five national polls in order to participate. It's a new bar that was set. If this standard had been used, Minnesota Governor Jesse Ventura wouldn't have participated in his debates, and Minnesota Ross Perot wouldn't have been able to participate in the first debates in 1992, and he ultimately got something around 30% of the vote. In the past, Pat Buchanan and Nader have sued the commission. Nader was most recently sued on Monday. The difference is Nader's taken a much more confrontational approach than Buchanan and actually tries to get into the debates. Once again, as in Boston, when he tried to get in, he was turned away by police. He spoke about this exclusion at a massive campaign rally. More than 15,000 people gathered at Madison Square Garden last Friday night, the largest campaign rally of this election season. And this is what he had to say.
Well, that debate was a massive, tedious exercise in platitudinous dittos. That's all it was. No. Yeah, I'll agree with that. I'll agree with that, all right.
They're chanting, "Let Ralph debate."
Let that's to you. I'll say one thing to you. If I was on those three debates, this election would be a lot different indeed. And I pledge to you this evening, before the largest political rally in the entire year in this presidential campaign, I'll pledge to you that never again will this crooked company called the Debate Commission, run by the Republican Democratic Party and funded by beer, tobacco, and auto money, never again will they hold the key to the gateway to tens of millions of American voters. Never again. Start. As some of you know, thank you. As some of you know, at the Boston debate, I had a ticket for the adjoining referendum, adjoining auditorium, just to watch the debate, in order to go on Fox News after the debate, which had a trailer right on the premises, University of Massachusetts, and comment on the debate. I disembarked from the bus, and I was met with a man who said he was a security consultant for the debate commission, flanked by three state troopers, and he said, even if you have a ticket, you are not invited and you must leave. Let me tell you. And a semi-embarrassed state trooper, I said that if I didn't leave, he'd place me under arrest. I told him he was being given an unlawful political order. Sergeant, well, let me tell you something. They threw out the wrong guy this time. Yes, indeed. On Monday, I file in federal district court a lawsuit against the corrupt debate commission. And you wait and see. And to the members of the press, you wait and see what the depositions are going to show. And after the election, we are going to start a People's Debate Commission to take over the debate process in America.
Ralph Nader speaking at his presidential rally last night, Friday night at Madison Square Garden, tried to get in last night at the debate, and he was turned back by police, though he did sue the Commission on Presidential Debates. But right now we're going to go inside University Hall at in St. Louis, Missouri, to that debate. And we're going to hear George Bush, Al Gore, and... Okay, we did what the police wouldn't allow. We brought Ralph Nader into the debate. Okay, sonically, we have spliced him in his comments on the issues that both candidates spoke about. I guess you could say this is what democracy sounds like.
Governor, next question is for you, and Leo Anderson will ask it. Mr. Anderson.
Hi, Leo. What? You want a mic?
In one of the last debates held, the subject of capital punishment came up. And in your response to the question, you seem overly enjoyed, as a matter of fact, proud that Texas led the nation in execution of prisoners. Sir, did I misread your response? And are you really, really proud of the fact that Texas is number one in executions?
No, I'm not proud of that. Death penalty is very serious business, Leo. It's an issue that good people obviously disagree on. I take my job seriously. And if you think I was proud of it, I think you misread me. I do. I was sworn to uphold the laws of my state. During the course of the campaign in 1994, I was asked, do you support the death penalty? I said I did, if administered fairly and justly. Because I believe it saves lives. You know, I do. I think if it's administered swiftly, justly, and fairly, it saves lives. One of the things that happens when you're a governor, at least oftentimes you have to make tough decisions. And you can't let public persuasion sway you because the job is to enforce the law. And that's what I did, sir. There have been some tough cases come across my desk. Some of the hardest moments since I've been the governor of the state of Texas is to deal with those cases. But my job is to ask two questions, sir. Is the person guilty of the crime? And did the person have full access to the courts of law? And I can tell you, looking at you right now, in all cases, those answers were affirmative. Now, I'm not proud of any record. I'm proud of the fact that violent crime is down in the state of Texas. I'm proud of the fact that that we hold people accountable. But I'm not proud of any record, sir. I'm not.
Vice President Gore?
I support the death penalty. I think that it has to be administered not only fairly with attention to things like DNA evidence, which I think should be used in all capital cases, but also with very careful attention. If for example, somebody confesses to the crime and somebody's waiting on death row, there has to be alertness to say, wait a minute, have we got the wrong guy? If the wrong guy is put to death, then that's a double tragedy. Not only has an innocent person been executed, but the real perpetrator of the crime has not been held accountable for it, and in some cases may be still at large. But I support the death penalty in the most heinous cases.
Do both of you believe that the death penalty actually deters crime, Governor?
I do. That's the only reason to be for it. Let me finish there.
Sure.
I don't think you should support the death penalty to seek revenge. I don't think that's right. I think the reason to support the death penalty is because it saves other people's lives.
Vice President Gore?
I think it is a deterrence. I know that's a controversial view, but I do believe it's a deterrence.
Mr. Nader, you've long expressed your opposition to the death penalty. Your response to your opponents?
Gore and Bush, they're both for the death penalty. They're both for cracking down on street crime, but ignoring corporate crime, which takes far more lives, far more injuries, and far more disease. We agree, says Gore and Bush. We agree, like two boxers in a clinch, you know. And Jim Lehrer desperately saying to him, tell the people the differences. Are there any differences? Are there any differences? I used to have to demonstrate how similar the two political parties were. We'd call them Tweedledum, Tweedledee, look-alike parties. Parties morphed into one corporate party with two heads wearing different makeup. And then come back, the frightened liberals would come back and say, yes, but there are some differences. And I would say, well, are they just rhetorical? Well, sweep aside the rhetoric. And he said, well, are they real differences? Well, the number begins to shrink when you sweep aside the rhetoric, because they do talk differently, but do they act differently? And you say, okay, you've sweeped aside the rhetoric. These are real differences? Yes. Well, do they fight for them? Do they fight for them, or do they just put it on a piece of paper and pander to you and flatter you instead of fighting for them? And then the frightened liberal says, but oh, what about the Supreme Court? Oh, the Supreme Court. Well, who are the two worst justices, oh, frightened liberal, to tell me? Well, the frightened liberal quickly says Scalia and Thomas. And to which I reply, well, why did the Democrats let those two get through the Senate? Did you know that the vote for Scalia was 98-0? Every Democrat, including Al Gore, voted for Scalia. The only two who didn't were absentee Republicans. And did you know in a democratically controlled U.S. Senate, in spite of the Anita Hill hearings, Clarence Thomas got through in a 52-48 vote with 11 senators who are Democrats who took him over the top while George Mitchell, the majority leader, was not exercising his power to defeat Clarence Thomas, the most unworthy successor you could ever imagine to Thurgood Marshall.
And you are listening to Ralph Nader joining Al Gore and George Bush in the presidential debate last night. No, not really. They were there. He was spliced in by Democracy Now! To this debate to give us a sense of, well, what did the Seattle protesters say? This is what democracy sounds like. We'll be back with the presidential debate in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I am Amy Goodman. As we continue with the presidential debate that took place last night in University Hall, St. Louis, Missouri, albeit a little edited, it is George Bush, Al Gore, and we broke through the police barricade sonically by editing in Ralph Nader to see what he might have said answered the questions of this town hall-style meeting. It was moderated by PBS NewsHour anchor Jim Lehrer, and he would introduce each of the people chosen in the audience who had asked a question. It was then written down, and they read their own questions like this.
Steve Luker has a question, and it is for Vice President Gore. Mr. Luker, there you are.
Vice President Gore, the family farms are disappearing and having a hard time, even in the current positive economic environment. What steps would you or your administration take on agriculture policy developments to protect the family farms for this multifunctional service they perform?
We've got a bumper crop this year, but that's the good news. You know what the bad news is that follows on that. The prices are low. In the last several years, the so-called freedom to farm law has, in my view, been mostly a failure. I want to change many of its provisions. Now, many here who are not involved in farming won't follow this, so just forgive me, because the 2% of the country that is involved in farming is important because the rest of us wouldn't eat except for them. And you guys have been having a hard time, and I want to fight for you. I want to change those provisions. I want to restore a meaningful safety net. And I think that you pointed the way in your comments, because when you say there are multiple things accomplished by farmers, you're specifically including conservation and protection of the environment. And yes, farmers are the first environmentalists. And when they decide not to plow a field that is vulnerable to soil erosion, that may cost them a little money, but it helps the environment. I think that we ought to have an expanded conservation reserve program. And I think that the environmental benefits that come from sound management of the land ought to represent a new way for farmers to get some income that will enable them, enable you to make sensible choices in crop rotation and when you leave the land fallow and the rest. Now, I'll go beyond that and say I think we need much more focused rural economic development programs. I see a time when the internet-based activities are more available in the rural areas and where the extra source of income that farm families used to have from shoe factories is replaced by an extra source of income from working in the information economy. So we need to do a lot of things, but we ought to start with a better safety net.
Governor Bush, 2 minutes.
I'd like our farmers feeding the world. We're the best producers in the world, and I want the farmers feeding the world. We need to open up markets. Exports are down, and every time an export number goes down, it hurts the farmer. I want the next president to have fast-track negotiating authority to open up markets around the world. We're the best. We're the most efficient farmers. I don't want to use food as a diplomatic weapon from this point forward. We shouldn't be using food. It hurts the farmers. It's not the right thing to do. I'm for value-added processing. We need to do more work on value-added processing. You should take the raw product you produce, I presume you're a farmer, off your farm, and convert it. I think value-added processing is important. I'm for research and development, spending research and development money so that we can use our technological base to figure out new uses for farm products. I'm for getting rid of the death tax, completely getting rid of the death tax. One reason family farmers are forced to sell early is because of the death tax. This is a bad tax. The president shouldn't have vetoed that bill. It's a tax that taxes people twice. It penalizes the family farmer. So should I be fortunate enough to earn your vote? I also understand that I'm going to open up markets, but I also understand that farming is a part of our national security. I'm from a big farm state with the second biggest state, farming state in the country. And I hear from my farmers and friends all the time. Vice President's right. By the way, every day is Earth Day if you own the land. And I like the policies that will encourage farmers to set aside land as well for conservation purposes. Thank you.
A quick thing on the inheritance tax. There is a difference between the two of you on this. Vice President Gore?
I'm for a massive reform of the estate tax or the death tax. And under the plan that I've proposed, 80% of all family farms will be completely exempt from the estate tax. And the vast majority of all family businesses would be completely exempt, and all of the others would have sharply reduced. So 80%. So. Now, the problem with completely eliminating it goes back to the wealthiest 1%. The amount of money that has to be raised in taxes from middle-class families to make up for completely eliminating that on the very wealthiest, the billionaires, that would be an extra heavy burden on middle class families. And so let's do it for most all, but not completely eliminate it for the very top.
What's the case for doing that, Governor?
Eliminating the death tax?
Completely, for everybody.
Because people shouldn't be taxed twice on their assets. It's either unfair for some or unfair for all. Again, this is just a difference of opinion. If you're from Washington, you want to pick and choose winners. I don't think that's the role of the president. I think if you're going to have tax relief, everybody benefits. Secondly, I think your plan, there's a lot of fine print in your plan, Mr. Vice President, in all due respect. It is, I'm not so sure 80% of the people get the death tax. I know this, 100% will get it if I'm the president. I just don't think it's fair to tax people's assets twice, regardless of your status. It's a fairness issue. It's an issue of principle, not politics.
Mr. Nader.
The word about the plight of the small family farmer for New York urbanites and suburbanites. Our country can ill afford to lose the rural life in this country and the small farm economy for our own reasons as urbanites and suburbanites, as well as the farmers. Clinton Gore and the Republicans have made sure that these giant agribusiness companies are squeezing the price, livelihood out of these farmers who are growing wheat, corn, soybeans, and other products. 30-40% lower in prices than it was in 1996. And that's not accruing to us as consumers. It's accruing to build up record-setting profits and executive compensation of the Cargills, the ADMs, the Smithfield Farms, the IBPs, the giant hog farms, and the giant cattle farms that are turning our entire farm economy into peonage, into industrial factory agriculture, laced by increasing encroachments of genetic engineering and all its mischief through farm economy. The Green Party stands for the preservation of the small farm economy in this country and the rural life that it graces. There are environmental groups also that are challenging the out-of-control biotechnology industry that is determined to change the nature of nature. And to transfer, through genetic engineering, the genetic inheritance of the world into 20-year monopoly patents held by Monsanto and Novartis and all these other companies that want to create a huge dependency, of our farmers on the switches, the chemical switches, the Terminator seeds, the traitor technologies, as they're called. And this is an industry whose technology is way ahead of the science. It must be its governing discipline. An industry that's out of control. An industry that has too much power in Washington. An industry that has brought Clinton and Gore to their knees in surrendering any regulatory framework worthy of the name to put the brakes on this industry.
What would make you the best candidate in office during the Middle East crisis?
I've been a leader. I've been a person who has to set a clear vision and convince people to follow. I got a strategy for the Middle East. And first, let me say that our nation now needs to speak with one voice during this time. And I applaud the president for working hard to defuse tensions. Our nation needs to be credible and strong. When we say we're somebody's friend, everybody's got to believe it. Israel's our friend, and we'll stand by Israel. We need to reach out to modern Arab nations as well, to build coalitions to keep the peace. I also need to, the next leader needs to be patient. We can't put the Middle East peace process on our timetable. It's got to be on the timetable of the people that are trying to, that we're trying to bring to the peace table. We can't dictate the terms of peace, which means that you have to be steady. You can't worry about polls or focus groups. You got to have a clear vision. That's what a leader does. A leader also understands that the United States must be strong to keep the peace. Saddam Hussein still is a threat in the Middle East. Our coalition against Saddam is unraveling. The sanctions are loosened. He's a man who may be developing weapons of mass destruction. We don't know because inspectors aren't in. So to answer your question requires a clear vision, a willingness to stand by our friends, and the credibility for people, both friend and foe, to understand when America says something, we mean it.
Vice President Gore?
I see a future when the world is at peace with the United States of America, promoting the values of democracy and human rights and freedom all around the world. Even in Iran, they have had an election that began to bring about some change. We stand for those values, and we have to be willing to assert them. Right now, our military is the strongest in the entire history of the world. I pledge to you, I will do whatever is necessary to make sure that it stays that way. Now, what can I bring to that challenge? When I was a young man, my father was a senator opposed to the Vietnam War. When I graduated from college, there were plenty of fancy ways to get out of going and being a part of that. I went and I volunteered, and I went to Vietnam. I didn't do the most or run the gravest risk by a long shot. But I learned what it was like to be an enlisted man in the United States Army. In the Congress, in the House of Representatives, I served on the House Intelligence Committee. And I worked hard to learn the subject of nuclear arms control and how we can defuse these tensions and deal with non-proliferation and deal with the problems of terrorism and these new weapons of mass destruction. Look, we're going to face some serious new challenges in the next 4 years. I've worked on that long and hard. When I went to the United States Senate, I asked for an assignment to the Armed Services Committee. And while I was there, I worked on a bipartisan basis, as I did in the House. I worked with former President Reagan on the modernization of our strategic weaponry. In the Senate, I was one of only 10 Democrats, along with Senator Joe Lieberman, to support Governor Bush's dad in the Persian Gulf War resolution. And for the last 8 years, I've served on the National Security Council. Could I say just one other thing here?
No, sir. We'll get back. The next question is to you.
And fine, I'll wait.
It's a related question. It's going to be asked by Kenneth Allen. Mr.
Right.
Allen?
I think that he gets I'm sorry, you're right. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Vice President. It seems that we keep excluding Mr. Nader from answering these questions. Ralph Nader.
Do you think the U.S. should cut off U.S. military aid to Israel while the killing goes on?
That won't do anything in the short run because, there's plenty of military weaponry over there. I think that would tend to boomerang. I think what they've got to do is quell the violence. It's almost all occurring in Palestinian territory with pretty, throwing rocks up against heavy military equipment. Quell it. Move it forward, maybe bring Jimmy Carter and others in, like a special series of ambassadors, new faces who have a record of promoting peace and are hard-headed about it and are unquestioned integrity.
What do you think of Gore's comment, we side with Israel, we are an honest mediator?
Well, I think, who was it on TV, was it... I forgot who was recently. Some former diplomat said you can't take sides in a situation like that. It's too inflammatory. You've got to go in as an honest broker. You can't be an honest broker if you're seen as siding one on one side or another. And that's common sense.
And you're listening to the presidential debate edited. That took place last night at University Hall in St. Louis, Missouri, between George Bush and Al Gore. And, well, we brought in Ralph Nader by editing in his comments that came from the Nader Rocks the Garden rally at Madison Square Garden on Friday night. And we're going to continue that with that debate in just a minute. And by the way, if you'd like to order a cassette copy, you can call the Pacifica Archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Back in a minute. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we go back to the Democracy Now! Version of the presidential debate that took place last night in St. Louis. Again, the moderator of these three presidential debates has been Jim Lehrer of PBS's NewsHour. He thought there were just two candidates in the room, and, well, there were three. We've got Al Gore, George Bush, and... Well, by editing miracles of our producers, Ralph Nader. This is Jim Lehrer.
All right, another health question. It comes from Vicky French, and it's for you, Vice President Gore. Vicky French, where are you? Oh, there she is. Yes.
We spend billions of dollars every year on taxes, or pay billions of dollars in taxes. Would you be open to the idea of a national health care plan for everybody? And if not, why? If so, is this something you would try to implement if you're elected into office? And what would you do to implement this plan?
I think that we should move step by step toward universal health coverage. But I am not in favor of government doing it all. We've spent 65 years now on the development of a hybrid system, partly private, partly public. And 85% of our people have health insurance, 15% don't. That adds up to 44 million people. That is a national outrage. We have got to get health coverage for those who do not have it. And we've got to improve the quality for those who do, with a patient's bill of rights that's real and that works, the Dingell-Norwood bill. And we have got to fill in the gaps in coverage by finally bringing parity for the treatment of mental illness, because that's been left out. We've got to deal with long-term care. Now, here are the steps that I would take first of all. I will make a commitment to bring health care coverage of high quality that is affordable to every single child in America within 4 years. And then we'll fill other gaps by covering the parents of those children when the family is poor, or up to 2.5 times the poverty rate. I want to give a tax credit for the purchase of individual health insurance plans. I want to give small business employers a tax credit, 25%, to encourage the providing of health insurance for the employees in small businesses. I want to give seniors who are, well, the near elderly, I don't like that term because I'm just about in that category, but those 55 to 65 ought to be able to buy into Medicare for premiums that are reasonable and fair and significantly below what they have to get now. Now, we have a big difference on this. And you need to know the record here. Under Governor Bush, Texas has sunk to be 50th out of 50 in health care, in health insurance for their citizens. Last week he said that they were spending $3.7 billion or $4.7 billion on this.
Mr. Vice President?
Okay.
Time is up. Governor Bush, 2 minutes.
I'm absolutely opposed to a national health care plan. I don't want the federal government making decisions for consumers or for providers. I remember what the administration tried to do in 1993. They tried to have a national health care plan, and fortunately it failed. I trust people. I don't trust the federal government. It's going to be one of the themes you hear tonight. I don't want the federal government making decisions on behalf of everybody. There is an issue with the uninsured. There sure is. And we've got uninsured people in my state. Ours is a big state, fast-growing state. We share a common border with another nation. But we're providing health care for our people. One thing about insurance, that's a Washington term. Question is, are people getting health care? And we've got a strong safety net. And there needs to be a safety net in America. There needs to be more community health clinics where the poor can go get health care. We need a program for the uninsured. They've been talking about it in Washington, D.C. The number of uninsured have now gone up for the past 7 years. We need a $2,000 credit rebate for people, working people who don't have insurance. They can get in the marketplace and start purchasing insurance. We need to have allow small businesses to write across insurance across jurisdictional lines so small business can afford health care. Small restaurants can afford health care. And so health care needs to be affordable and available. But we got to trust people to make decisions with their lives. And the Medicare reform I talk about, it says if you're a senior, you can stay in Medicare if you like it. And that's fine. But we're going to give you other choices to choose if you want to do so, just like they do the federal employees, the people who work in Washington, D.C., for the U.S. Congress or the United States Senate, get a variety of choices to make in their lives. And that's what we ought to do for Governor. All people in America. Yes, sir. Sorry.
Governor?
Could I have a follow-up?
Not paying attention
to
my lights.
No, right now. Well, not right now. Education.
Trying to find my light.
These folks submitted 18 questions on education.
Hey, you guys are acting like Ralph Nader isn't even in the room. Of course he isn't, because the police chief barred him from entering. But Ralph Nader, what do you have to say about universal health care?
Why don't people in this country have the same universal health insurance coverage that the members of Congress give to themselves? Because we don't have the power yet. Whenever they tell you there's not enough money for legal services for the poor, not enough money for prosecutors against corporate crime, when they say there's not enough money for universal health care, when they say there's not enough money for daycare, you just say, how come there are hundreds of billions of our hard-earned tax dollars going to corporate subsidies, handouts, giveaways, and bailouts of corporations? The Green Party says, get them off welfare once and for all. I ask you, what has Clinton Gore done on health insurance? 10 million more people are uninsured than when Clinton Gore took office. It's now 46 million. It was about 35 million in 1993. Maybe that's what Al Gore means when he says he wants to take us to universal health insurance step by step. I guess it's backwards, not forwards.
Governor Bush, Norma Kirby has the next question, and it's for you. Norma Kirby, okay. Where are you?
Hi, Norma.
Hi. How will your administration address diversity, inclusiveness, and what role will affirmative action play in your overall plan?
I've had a record of bringing people from all walks of life into my administration, and my administration is better off for it in Texas. I'm going to find people that want to serve their country, but I want a diverse administration. I think it's important. I've worked hard in the state of Texas to make sure our institutions reflect the state with good, smart policy. Policy that rejects quotas. I don't like quotas. Quotas tend to pit one group of people against another. Quotas are bad for America. It's not the way America is all about. But policies that give people a helping hand so they can help themselves. For example, in our state of Texas, I worked with the legislature, both Republicans and Democrats, to pass a law that said if you come in the top 10% of your high school class, you're automatically admitted to one of our higher institutions of learning, college. And as a result, our universities are now more diverse. It was a smart thing to do. Is what I called it. I labeled it affirmative access. I think the contracting business in government can help, not with quotas, but help meet a goal of ownership of small businesses, for example. The contracts need to be smaller. The agencies need to be, need to recruit and to work hard to find people to bid on the state contracts. I think we can do that in a way that that represents what America is all about, which is equal opportunity and an opportunity for people to realize their potential. So to answer your question, I support, I guess the way to put it is affirmative access. And I'll have an administration that will make you proud. Thank you.
Mr. President Gore.
I believe in this goal and this effort with all my heart. I believe that our future as a nation depends upon whether or not we can break down these barriers that have been used to pit group against group and bring our people together. How do you do it? Well, you establish respect for differences. You don't ignore differences. It's all too easy for somebody in the majority in the population to say, oh, we're just all the same, without an understanding of the different life experience that you've had, that others have had. Once you have that understanding and mutual respect, then we can transcend the differences and embrace the highest common denominator of the American spirit. I don't know what affirmative access means. I do know what affirmative action means. I know the governor's against it, and I know that I'm for it. I know what a hate crime statute pending at the national level is all about in the aftermath of James Byrd's death. I'm for that proposed law. The governor is against it. I know what it means to have a commitment to diversity. I am part of an administration that has the finest record on diversity and incidentally, an excellent I think our success over the last 8 years has not been in spite of diversity, but because of it, because we're able to draw on the wisdom and experience from different parts of the society that hadn't been tapped in the same way before. And incidentally, Mel Carnahan in Missouri had the finest record on diversity of any governor in the entire history of the state of Missouri, and I want to honor that among his other achievements here. Now, I just believe that what we have to do is enforce the civil rights laws. I'm against quotas. This is, with all due respect to Governor, that's a red herring. Affirmative action isn't quotas. I'm against quotas. They're illegal. They're against the American way. Affirmative action means that you take extra steps to acknowledge the history of discrimination and injustice and prejudice and bring all people into the American dream, because it helps everybody, not just those who are directly benefited.
Governor, are you opposed to affirmative action?
No, if affirmative action means quotas, I'm against it. If affirmative action means what I just described, what I'm for, then I'm for it. You heard what I was for. Vice President keeps saying I'm against things. You heard what I was for. And that's what I support.
What about, Mr. Vice President, you heard what he said.
He said if affirmative action means quotas, he's against it. Affirmative action doesn't mean
good
quotas. Are you for it without quotas?
Well, I may not be for your version, Mr. Vice President, but I am for what I just described to the lady. She
Are you
my
for
answer?
What the Supreme Court says is a constitutional way of having affirmative action?
Jim, just...
Let's go on to another And
I think that speaks
it's a question.
Itself.
No, it doesn't speak for itself, Mr. Vice President. It speaks for the fact that there are certain rules in this that we all agree to, but evidently rules don't mean anything.
Well, clearly those rules do mean something. They mean third-party candidates are excluded from this debate. Well, let's try to remedy that for a second. Ralph Nader, your views on the issue of diversity.
I'm sick and tired of white politicians like Clinton and Gore going to black churches and with that rhythmic cadence pandering to them and then betraying them and then betraying them. Look, what has Clinton and Gore done for the racism and the poverty in this country? Let me give you some information. If any frightened liberals really think that the Democrats are different than the Republicans, in fact, on civil rights, let me suggest to you that the Justice Department lawyers in the Civil Rights Division have informed us that on 2 out of 3 enforcement litigation areas, police illegal use of violence and affirmative action, that Clinton Gore were worse than Reagan Bush. Only in anti-housing discrimination were they better. Imagine that. They don't say that in black churches, do they?
All right, the next question also on health issue is from, it will be asked by Marie Payne Clapey, and it goes to Governor Bush.
Are either of you concerned with...
Here you go.
I've got...
Are either of you concerned with finding some feasible way to lower the price of pharmaceutical drugs, such as education on minimizing intake, revamp of the FDA process, or streamline the drug company's procedures instead of just finding more money to pay for them?
Well, that's a great question. I think one of the problems we have, particularly for seniors, is there's no prescription drug coverage in Medicare. And therefore, when they have to try to purchase drugs, they do so on their own. There's no kind of collective bargaining. There's no power of purchasing among seniors. So I think step one to make sure prescription drugs is more affordable for seniors, and those are the folks who really rely upon prescription drugs a lot these days, is to reform the Medicare system, is to have prescription drugs as an integral part of Medicare once and for all. The problem we have today is that, like the Patient's Bill of Rights, particularly with health care, there's a lot of bickering in Washington, D.C. It's kind of like a political issue as opposed to a people issue. So what I want to do is I want to call upon Republicans and Democrats to forget all the arguing and finger-pointing and come together and take care of our seniors with a prescription drug program that says we'll pay for the poor seniors, we'll help all seniors with prescription drugs. In the meantime, I think it's important to have what's called immediate helping hand. which is direct money to states so that seniors, poor seniors, don't have to choose between food and medicine. That's part of an overall overhaul. But purchasing power is important. I'm against price controls. I think price controls would hurt our ability to continue important research and development. Drug therapies are replacing a lot of medicines as we used to know it. One of the most important things is to continue the research and development component. And so I'm against price controls. Expediting drugs through the FDA makes sense, of course. Allowing the new bill that was passed in the Congress made sense to allow for drugs that were sold overseas to come back in other countries to come back into the United States. That makes sense. But the best thing to do is to reform Medicare.
Vice President Gore, 2 minutes.
All right, here we go again. Now, look, if you want someone who will spend a lot of words describing a whole convoluted process and then end up supporting legislation that is supported by the big drug companies, this is your man. If you want someone who will fight for you and who will fight for the middle-class families and working men and women who are sick and tired of having their parents and grandparents pay higher prices for prescription drugs than anybody else, then I want to fight for you. And you asked a great question, because it's not only seniors. Listen, for 24 years, I have never been afraid to take on the big drug companies. They do some great things. They discover great new cures, and that's great. We want them to continue that. But they are now spending more money on advertising and promotion, you see all these ads, than they are on research and development. And they're trying to artificially extend the monopoly patent to protection so they can keep charging these very high prices. I want to streamline the approval of the competing generic drugs and the new kinds of treatments that can compete with them so that we bring the price down for everybody. Now, briefly, let me tell you how my prescription drug plan works. The governor talked about Medicare. I propose a real prescription drug benefit under Medicare for all seniors. All seniors. And here's how it works. You pick your own doctor, and nobody can take that away from you. The doctor chooses the prescription that you need, and nobody can overrule your doctor. You go to your own pharmacy, and then Medicare pays half the price. If you're poor, they pay all of it. If you have extraordinarily high cost, then they pay all over $4,000 out of pocket. And I'll bring new competition to bring the price down. And if you pass the big drug companies bill, nothing will happen.
Mr. Nader, the question of prescription drugs.
You want to know what money is like in Washington? How we have to clean up the corruption of money? Since 1997, the drug industry, lobbying Congress, has spent $237 million. One industry. You know who pays for that? In higher drug prices and prescription medicines.
And that does it for the Democracy Now! Presidential debate that took place last night. Al Gore and George Bush were the invited guests. We invited in Ralph Nader sonically. We edited in his responses. That does it for the program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Jillian Aldrich and Sidrock Franklin with deep appreciation. I'm Amy Goodman from the studios of WBAI in New York with Matthew Finch, our engineer. Thanks for listening.
five large media firms.